Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, by Ayn Rand, continued, Disc 5. The attempt to protect the consumer by force undercuts the protection he gets from incentive. First, it undercuts the value of reputation by placing the reputable company on the same basis as the unknown, the newcomer, or the fly-by-nighter. It declares, in effect, that all are equally suspect, and that years of evidence to the contrary do not free a man from that suspicion. Second, it grants an automatic, though in fact unachievable, guarantee of safety to the products of any company that complies with its arbitrarily set minimum standards. The value of a reputation rested on the fact that it was necessary for the consumers to exercise judgment in the choice of the goods and services they purchased. The government's guarantee undermines this necessity. It declares to the consumers, in effect, that no choice or judgment is required, and that a company's record, its years of achievement, is irrelevant. The minimum standards, which are the basis of regulation, gradually tend to become the maximums as well. If the building codes set minimum standards of construction, a builder does not get very much competitive advantage by exceeding those standards, and accordingly he tends to meet only the minimums. If minimum specifications are set for vitamins, there is little profit in producing something of above average quality. Gradually, even the attempt to maintain minimum standards becomes impossible, since the draining of incentives to improve quality ultimately undermines even the minimums. The guiding purpose of the government regulator is to prevent rather than to create something. He gets no credit if a new miraculous drug is discovered by drug company scientists. He does if he bans thalidomide. Such emphasis on the negative sets the framework under which even the most conscientious regulators must operate. The result is a growing body of restrictive legislation on drug experimentation, testing, and distribution. As in all research, it is impossible to add restrictions to the development of new drugs without simultaneously cutting off the secondary rewards of such research, the improvement of existing drugs. Quality improvement and innovation are inseparable. Building codes are supposed to protect the public, but by being forced to adhere to standards of construction long after they have been surpassed by new technological discoveries, builders divert their efforts to maintaining the old rather than adopting new and safer techniques of construction. Regulation, which is based on force and fear, undermines the moral base of business dealings. It becomes cheaper to bribe a building inspector than to meet his standards of construction. A fly-by-night securities operator can quickly meet all the SEC requirements, gain the inference of respectability, and proceed to fleece the public. In an unregulated economy, the operator would have had to spend a number of years in reputable dealings before he could earn a position of trust sufficient to induce a number of investors to place funds with him. Protection of the consumer by regulation is thus illusory. Rather than isolating the consumer from the dishonest businessman, it is gradually destroying the only reliable protection the consumer has, competition for reputation. While the consumer is thus endangered, the major victim of protective regulation is the producer, the businessman. Regulation, which acts to destroy the competition of businessmen for reputation, undermines the market value of the goodwill which businessmen have built up over the years. It is an act of expropriation of wealth created by integrity. Since the value of a business, its wealth, rests on its ability to make money, the acts of a government seizing a company's plant or devaluing its reputation are in the same category. Both are acts of expropriation. Moreover, protective legislation falls in the category of preventive law. Businessmen are being subjected to governmental coercion prior to the commission of any crime. In a free economy, the government may step in only when a fraud has been perpetrated or a demonstrable damage has been done to a consumer. In such cases, the only protection required is that of criminal law. Government regulations do not eliminate potentially dishonest individuals, but merely make their activities harder to detect or easier to hush up. Furthermore, the possibility of individual dishonesty applies to government employees fully as much as to any other group of men. There is nothing to guarantee the superior judgment, knowledge, and integrity of an inspector or a bureaucrat, and the deadly consequences of entrusting him with arbitrary power are obvious. The hallmark of collectivists is their deep-rooted distrust of freedom and of the free market processes, but it is their advocacy of so-called consumer protection that exposes the nature of their basic premises with particular clarity. By preferring force and fear to incentive and reward as a means of human motivation, they confess their view of man as a mindless brute, functioning on the range of the moment, whose actual self-interest lies in flying by night and making quick kills. They confess their ignorance of the role of intelligence in the production process, of the wide intellectual context and long-range vision required to maintain a modern industry. They confess their inability to grasp the crucial importance of the moral values which are the motive power of capitalism. Capitalism is based on self-interest and self-esteem. It holds integrity and trustworthiness as cardinal virtues and makes them pay off in the marketplace, thus demanding that men survive by means of virtues, not of vices. It is this superlatively moral system that the welfare statists propose to improve upon by means of preventive law, snooping bureaucrats, and the chronic goad of fear. Chapter 10. The Property Status of Airwaves by Ayn Rand. Any material element or resource which, in order to become of use or value to men, requires the application of human knowledge and effort, should be private property, by the right of those who apply the knowledge and effort. This is particularly true of broadcasting frequencies or waves, because they are produced by human action and do not exist without it. What exists in nature is only the potential and the space through which those waves must travel. Just as two trains cannot travel on the same section of track at the same time, so two broadcasts cannot use the same frequency at the same time, in the same area, without jamming each other. There is no difference in principle between the ownership of land and the ownership of airways. The only issue is the task of defining the application of property rights to this particular sphere. It is on this task that the American government has failed dismally, with incalculably disastrous consequences. There is no essential difference between a broadcast and a concert. The former merely transmits sounds over a longer distance and requires more complex technical equipment. No one would venture to claim that a pianist may own his fingers and his piano, but the space inside the concert hall, through which the sound waves he produces travel, is public property, and therefore he has no right to give a concert without a license from the government. Yet this is the absurdity foisted on our broadcasting industry. The chief argument in support of the notion that broadcasting frequencies should be public property has been stated succinctly by Justice Frankfurter. Radio facilities are limited. They are not available to all who may wish to use them. The radio spectrum simply is not large enough to accommodate everybody. There is a fixed, natural limitation upon the number of stations that can operate without interfering with one another. The fallacy of this argument is obvious. The number of broadcasting frequencies is limited. So is the number of concert halls. So is the amount of oil or wheat or diamonds. So is the acreage of land on the surface of the globe. There is no material element or value that exists in unlimited quantity. And if a wish to use a certain facility is the criterion of the right to use it, then the universe is simply not large enough to accommodate all those who harbor wishes for the unearned. It is the proper task of the government to protect individual rights, and as part of it, to formulate the laws by which these rights are to be implemented and adjudicated. It is the government's responsibility to define the application of individual rights to a given sphere of activity. To define, i.e. to identify, not to create, invent, donate, or expropriate. The question of defining the application of property rights has arisen frequently in the wake of major scientific discoveries or inventions, such as the question of oil rights, vertical space rights, etc. In most cases, the American government was guided by the proper principle. It sought to protect all the individual rights involved, not to abrogate them. A notable example of the proper method of establishing private ownership from scratch in a previously ownerless area is the Homestead Act of 1862, by which the government opened the western frontier for settlement and turned public land over to private owners. The government offered a 160-acre farm to any adult citizen who would settle on it and cultivate it for 5 years, after which it would become his property. Although that land was originally regarded in law as public property, the method of its allocation, in fact, followed the proper principle, in fact, but not in explicit ideological intention. The citizens did not have to pay the government as if it were an owner. Ownership began with them, and they earned it by the method which is the source and root of the concept of property, by working on unused material resources, by turning a wilderness into a civilized settlement. Thus, the government in this case was acting not as the owner, but as the custodian of ownerless resources, who defines objectively impartial rules by which potential owners may acquire them. This should have been the principle and pattern of the allocation of broadcasting frequencies. As soon as it became apparent that radio broadcasting had opened a new realm of material resources which, in the absence of legal definitions, would become a wilderness of clashing individual claims, the government should have promulgated the equivalent of a Homestead Act of the Airways, an act defining private property rights in the new realm, establishing the rule that the user of a radio frequency would own it after he had operated a station for a certain number of years, and allocating all frequencies by the rule of priority, i.e., first come, first served. Bear in mind that the development of commercial radio took many years of struggle and experimentation, and that the gold rush of the wishers did not start until the pioneers, who had taken the risks of venturing into the unknown, had built it into a bright promise of great commercial value. By what right, code, or standard was anyone entitled to that value, except the men who had created it? If the government had adhered to the principle of private property rights, and the pioneers' ownership had been legally established, then a latecomer who wished to acquire a radio station would have had to buy it from one of the original owners, as is the case with every other type of property. The fact that the number of available frequencies was limited would have served not to entrench the original owners, but to threaten their hold if they did not make the best economic use of their property, which is what free competition does to every other type of property. With a limited supply and a growing demand, competition would have driven the market value of a radio and later TV station so high that only the most competent men could have afforded to buy it or to keep it. A man unable to make a profit could not have long afforded to waste so valuable a property. Who on a free market determines the economic success or failure of an enterprise? The public. The public as a sum of individual producers, viewers, and listeners, each making his own decisions, not as a single, helpless, disembodied collective with a few bureaucrats posturing as the spokesman of its will on earth. Contrary to the argument from scarcity, if you want to make a limited resource available to the whole people, make it private property and throw it on a free open market. The agreement from scarcity, incidentally, is outdated, even in its literal meaning. With the discovery of ultra-high frequencies, there are more broadcasting channels available today than prospective applicants willing to pioneer in their development. As usual, the wishers seek not to create, but to take over the rewards and advantages created by others. The history of the collectivization of radio and television demonstrates, in condensed form, in a kind of microcosm, the process and the causes of capitalism's destruction. It is an eloquent illustration of the fact that capitalism is perishing by the philosophical default of its alleged defenders. Collectivists frequently cite the early years of radio as an example of the failure of free enterprise. In those years, when broadcasters had no property rights in radio, no legal protection or recourse, the airways were a chaotic no-man's land where anyone could use any frequency he pleased and jam anyone else. Some professional broadcasters tried to divide their frequencies by private agreements, which they could not enforce on others. Nor could they fight the interference of stray, maliciously mischievous amateurs. This state of affairs was used then and now to urge and justify government control of radio. This is an instance of capitalism taking the blame for the evils of its enemies. The chaos of the airways was an example not of free enterprise, but of anarchy. It was caused not by private property rights, but by their absence. It demonstrated why capitalism is incompatible with anarchism, why men do need a government, and what is a government's proper function. What was needed was legality, not controls. What was imposed was worse than controls, outright nationalization. By a gradual, uncontested process, by ideological default, it was taken for granted that the airways belong to the people and are public property. If you want to know the intellectual state of the time, I will ask you to guess the political ideology of the author of the following quotation. Radio communication is not to be considered as merely a business carried on for private gain, for private advertisement, or for entertainment of the curious. It is a public concern, impressed with the public trust, and to be considered primarily from the standpoint of public interest, in the same extent and upon the basis of the same general principles as our other public utilities. No, this was not said by a business-hating collectivist eager to establish the supremacy of the public interest over private gain. It was not said by a socialist planner, nor by a communist conspirator. It was said by Herbert Hoover, then Secretary of Commerce in 1924. It was Hoover who fought for government control of radio, and as Secretary of Commerce made repeated attempts to extend government power beyond the limits set by the legislation of the time, attempts to attach detailed conditions to radio licenses, which he had no legal authority to do, and which were repeatedly negated by the courts. It was Hoover's influence that was largely responsible for that tombstone of the radio and the then unborn television industry known as the Act of 1927, which established the Federal Radio Commission with all of its autocratic, discretionary, undefined, and undefinable powers. That act, with minor revisions and amendments, including the Act of 1934, that changed the Federal Radio Commission into the Federal Communications Commission, is still, in all essential respects, the basic legal document ruling the broadcasting industry today. What we are doing, said FCC Chairman Newton N. Minow in 1962, did not begin with the new frontier. He was right. The Act of 1927 did not confine the government to the role of a traffic policeman of the air, who protects the rights of broadcasters from technical interference, which is all that was needed and all that a government should properly do. It established service to the public interest, convenience, or necessity as the criterion by which the Federal Radio Commission was to judge applicants for broadcasting licenses and accept or reject them. Since there is no such thing as the public interest, other than the sum of the individual interests of individual citizens, since that collectivist catchphrase has never been and can never be defined, it amounted to a blank check on totalitarian power over the broadcasting industry, granted to whatever bureaucrats happened to be appointed to the commission. The public interest, that intellectual knife of collectivism's sacrificial guillotine, which the operators of broadcasting stations have to test by placing their heads on the block every 3 years, was not raised over their heads by capitalism's enemies, but by their leaders. It was the so-called conservatives, including some of the pioneers, some of the broadcasting industry's executives who today are complaining and protesting, who ran to the government for regulations and controls, who cheered the notion of public property and service to the public interest, and thus planted the seeds of which Mr. Minow and Mr. Henry are merely the logical, consistent flowers. The broadcasting industry was enslaved with the sanction of the victims, but they were not fully innocent victims. Many businessmen of the mixed economy persuasion resent the actual nature of capitalism. They believe that it is safer to hold a position not by right, but by favor. They dread the competition of a free market, and they feel that a bureaucrat's friendship is much easier to win. Pull, not merit, is their form of social security. They believe that they will always succeed at courting, pressuring, or bribing a bureaucrat who is a good fellow they can get along with and who will protect them from that merciless stranger, the abler competitor. Consider the special privileges to be found in the status of a certified servant of the public interest and a licensed user of public property. Not only does it place a man outside the reach of economic competition, but it also spares him the responsibility and the costs entailed in private property. It grants him gratuitously the use of a broadcasting frequency for which he would have had to pay an enormous price on a free market and would not have been able to keep for long if he sent forth through the air the kind of unconscionable trash he is sending forth today. Such are the vested interests made possible by the doctrine of the public interest, and such are the beneficiaries of any form, version, or degree of the doctrine of public property. Now observe the practical demonstration of the fact that without property rights, no other rights are possible. If censorship and the suppression of free speech ever get established in this country, they will have originated in radio and television. The Act of 1927 granted to a government commission total power over the professional fate of broadcasters, with the public interest as the criterion of judgment, and simultaneously forbade the commission to censor radio programs. From the start, and progressively louder through the years, many voices have been pointing out that this is a contradiction impossible to practice. If a commissioner has to judge which applicant for a broadcasting license will best serve the public interest, how can he judge it without judging the content, nature, and value of the programs the applicants have offered or will offer? If capitalism had had any proper intellectual defenders, it is they who should have been loudest in opposing a contradiction of that kind. But such was not the case. It was the statists who seized upon it, not in defense of free speech, but in support of the commission's right to censor programs. And so long as the criterion of the public interest stood unchallenged, logic was on the side of the statists. The result was what it had to be, illustrating once more the power of basic principles. By gradual, unobtrusive, progressively accelerating steps, the commission enlarged its control over the content of radio and television programs, leading to the open threats and ultimatums of Mr. Minow, who merely made explicit what had been known implicitly for many years. No, the commission did not censor specific programs. It merely took cognizance of program content at license renewal time. What was established was worse than open censorship, which could be knocked out in a court of law. It was the unprovable, intangible, insidious censorship by displeasure, the usual and only result of any non-objective legislation. All media of communication influence one another. It is impossible to compute the extent to which the gray, docile, fear-ridden, appeasement-minded mediocrity of so powerful a medium as television has contributed to the demoralization of our culture. Nor can the freedom of one medium of communication be destroyed without affecting all the others. When censorship of radio and television becomes fully accepted as a fait accompli, it will not be long before all the other media, books, magazines, newspapers, lectures, follow suit, unobtrusively, unofficially, and by the same method. Overtly, in the name of the public interest. Covertly, for fear of government reprisals. This process is taking place already. So much for the relationship of human rights to property rights. Since public property is a collectivist fiction, since the public as a whole can neither use nor dispose of its property, that property will always be taken over by some political elite, by a small clique which will then rule the public, a public of literal, dispossessed proletarians. If you want to gauge a collectivist theory's distance from reality, ask yourself, by what inconceivable standard can it be claimed that the broadcasting airways are the property of some illiterate sharecropper who will never be able to grasp the concept of electronics, or of some hillbilly whose engineering capacity is not quite sufficient to cope with a corn liquor still, and that broadcasting, the product of an incalculable amount of scientific genius, is to be ruled by the will of such owners. Remember that this, literally, is the alleged principle at the base of the entire legal structure of our broadcasting industry. There is only one solution to this problem, and it has to start at the base. Nothing less will do. The airways should be turned over to private ownership. The only way to do it now is to sell radio and television frequencies to the highest bidders, by an objectively defined, open, impartial process, and thus put an end to the gruesome fiction of public property. Such a reform cannot be accomplished overnight. It will take a long struggle, but that is the ultimate goal which the advocates of capitalism should bear in mind. That is the only way to correct the disastrous, atavistic error made by capitalism's alleged defenders. I say atavistic because it took many centuries before primitive nomadic tribes of savages reached the concept of private property, specifically land property, which marked the beginning of civilization. It is a tragic irony that in the presence of a new realm opened by a gigantic achievement of science, our political and intellectual leaders reverted to the mentality of primitive nomads, and unable to conceive of property rights, declared the new realm to be a tribal hunting ground. The breach between man's scientific achievements and his ideological development is growing wider every day. It is time to realize that men cannot keep this up much longer if they continue to retrogress to ideological savagery with every step of scientific progress. Chapter 11, Patents and Copyrights, by Ayn Rand. Patents and copyrights are the legal implementation of the base of all property rights, a man's right to the product of his mind. Every type of productive work involves a combination of mental and physical effort, of thought and of physical action to translate that thought into a material form. The proportion of these two elements varies in different types of work. At the lowest end of the scale, the mental effort required to perform unskilled manual labor is minimal. At the other end, what the patent and copyright laws acknowledge is the paramount role of mental effort in the production of material values. These laws protect the mind's contribution in its purest form, the origination of an idea. The subject of patents and copyrights is intellectual property. An idea as such cannot be protected until it has been given a material form. An invention has to be embodied in a physical model before it can be patented. A story has to be written or printed. But what the patent or copyright protects is not the physical object as such, but the idea which it embodies. By forbidding an unauthorized reproduction of the object, the law declares, in effect, that the physical labor of copying is not the source of the object's value, that that value is created by the originator of the idea, and may not be used without his consent. Thus the law establishes the property right of a mind to that which it has brought into existence. It is important to note in this connection that a discovery cannot be patented, only an invention. A scientific or philosophical discovery, which identifies a law of nature, a principle, or a fact of reality not previously known, cannot be the exclusive property of the discoverer, because A, he did not create it, and B, if he cares to make his discovery public, claiming it to be true, he cannot demand that men continue to pursue or practice falsehoods except by his permission. He can copyright the book in which he presents his discovery, and he can demand that his authorship of the discovery be acknowledged, that no other man appropriate or plagiarize the credit for it. But he cannot copyright theoretical knowledge. Patents and copyrights pertain only to the practical application of knowledge, to the creation of a specific object which did not exist in nature, an object which, in the case of patents, may never have existed without its particular originator, and in the case of copyrights, would never have existed. The government does not grant a patent or copyright in the sense of a gift, privilege, or favor. The government merely secures it, i.e., the government certifies the origination of an idea and protects its owner's exclusive right of use and disposal. A man is not forced to apply for a patent or copyright. He may give his idea away if he so chooses. But if he wishes to exercise his property right, the government will protect it, as it protects all other rights. A patent or copyright represents the formal equivalent of registering a property deed or title. The patent or copyright notice on a physical object represents a public statement of the conditions on which the inventor or author is willing to sell his product, for the purchaser's use, but not for commercial reproduction. The right to intellectual property cannot be exercised in perpetuity. Intellectual property represents a claim not on material objects, but on the idea they embody, which means not merely on existing wealth, but on wealth yet to be produced, a claim to payment for the inventor's or author's work. No debt can be extended into infinity. Material property represents a static amount of wealth already produced. It can be left to heirs, but it cannot remain in their effortless possession in perpetuity. The heirs can consume it or must earn its continued possession by their own productive work. The greater the value of the property, the greater the effort demanded of the heir. In a free competitive society, no one could long retain the ownership of a factory or of a tract of land without exercising a commensurate effort. But intellectual property cannot be consumed. If it were held in perpetuity, it would lead to the opposite of the very principle on which it is based. It would lead not to the earned reward of achievement, but to the unearned support of parasitism. It would become a cumulative lien on the production of unborn generations, which would ultimately paralyze them. Consider what would happen if, in producing an automobile, we had to pay royalties to the descendants of all the inventors involved, starting with the inventor of the wheel and on up. Apart from the impossibility of keeping such records, consider the accidental status of such descendants and the unreality of their unearned claims. The inheritance of material property represents a dynamic claim on a static amount of wealth. The inheritance of intellectual property represents a static claim on a dynamic process of production. Intellectual achievement, in fact, cannot be transferred, just as intelligence, ability, or any other personal virtue cannot be transferred. All that can be transferred is the material results of an achievement in the form of actually produced wealth. By the very nature of the right on which intellectual property is based, a man's right to the product of his mind, that right ends with him. He cannot dispose of that which he cannot know or judge. The yet unproduced, indirect, potential results of his achievement 4 generations or 4 centuries later. It is in this issue that our somewhat collectivist terminology might be misleading. On the expiration of a patent or copyright, the intellectual property involved does not become public property. Though it is labeled as in the public domain, it ceases to exist qua property. And if the invention or the book continues to be manufactured, the benefit of that former property does not go to the public. It goes to the only rightful heirs, to the producers, to those who exercise the effort of embodying that idea in new material forms and thus keeping it alive. Since intellectual property rights cannot be exercised in perpetuity, the question of their time limit is an enormously complex issue. If they were restricted to the originator's lifespan, it would destroy their value by making long-term contractual agreements impossible. If an inventor died a month after his invention were placed on the market, it could ruin the manufacturer who may have invested a fortune in its production. Under such conditions, investors would be unable to take a long-range risk. The more revolutionary or important an invention, the less would be its chance of finding financial backers. Therefore, the law has to define a period of time which would protect the rights and interests of all those involved. In the case of copyrights, the most rational solution is Great Britain's Copyright Act of 1911, which established the copyright of books, paintings, movies, etc., for the lifetime of the author and 50 years thereafter. In the case of patents, the issue is much more complex. A patented invention often tends to hamper or restrict further research and development in a given area of science. Many patents cover overlapping areas. The difficulty lies in defining the inventor's specific rights without including more than he can properly claim in the form of indirect consequences or yet undiscovered implications. A lifetime patent could become an unjustifiable barrier to the development of knowledge beyond the inventor's potential power or actual achievement. The legal problem is to set a time limit which would secure for the inventor the fullest possible benefit of his invention without infringing the right of others to pursue independent research. As in many other legal issues, that time limit has to be determined by the principle of defining and protecting all the individual rights involved. As an objection to the patent laws, some people cite the fact that two inventors may work independently for years on the same invention, but one will beat the other to the patent office by an hour or a day and will acquire an exclusive monopoly, while the loser's work will then be totally wasted. This type of objection is based on the error of equating the potential with the actual. The fact that a man might have been first does not alter the fact that he wasn't. Since the issue is one of commercial rights, the loser in a case of that kind has to accept the fact that in seeking to trade with others, he must face the possibility of a competitor winning the race, which is true of all types of competition. Today, patents are the special target of the collectivists' attacks, directly and indirectly, through such issues as the proposed abolition of trademarks, brand names, etc. While the so-called conservatives look at those attacks indifferently, or at times approvingly, the collectivists seem to realize that patents are the heart and core of property rights, and that once they are destroyed, the destruction of all other rights will follow automatically as a brief postscript. The present state of our patent system is a nightmare. The inventor's rights are being infringed, eroded, chipped, gnawed, and violated in so many ways, under cover of so many non-objective statutes, that industrialists are beginning to rely on secrecy to protect valuable inventions which they are afraid to patent. Consider the treatment accorded to patents under the antitrust laws as just one example out of many. Those who observe the spectacle of the progressive collapse of patents, the spectacle of mediocrity scrambling to cash in on the achievements of genius, and who understand its implications, will understand why, in the closing paragraphs of Chapter 7, Part 2 of Atlas Shrugged, one of the guiltiest men is the passenger who said, "Why should Reardon be the only one permitted to manufacture Reardon metal?" Chapter 12, Theory and Practice, by Ayn Rand. The Man-Haters. Few errors are as naive and suicidal as the attempts of the conservatives to justify capitalism on altruistic, collectivist grounds. Many people believe that altruism means kindness, benevolence, or respect for the rights of others. But it means the exact opposite. It teaches self-sacrifice, as well as the sacrifice of others, to any unspecified public need. It regards man as a sacrificial animal. Believing that collectivists are motivated by an authentic concern for the welfare of mankind, capitalism's alleged defenders assure its enemies that capitalism is the practical road to the socialists' goal, the best means to the same end, the best servant of public needs. Then they wonder why they fail, and why the bloody muck of socialization keeps oozing forward over the face of the globe. They fail because no one's welfare can be achieved by anyone's sacrifice, and because man's welfare is not the socialist's goal. It is not for its alleged flaws that the altruist collectivists hate capitalism, but for its virtues. If you doubt it, consider a few examples. Many collectivist historians criticize the Constitution of the United States on the ground that its authors were rich landowners, who allegedly were motivated not by any political ideals, but only by their own selfish economic interests. This, of course, is not true, but it is true that capitalism does not require the sacrifice of anyone's interests, and what is significant here is the nature of the morality behind the collectivist's argument. Prior to the American Revolution, through centuries of feudalism and monarchy, the interests of the rich lay in the expropriation, enslavement, and misery of the rest of the people. A society, therefore, where the interests of the rich require general freedom, unrestricted productiveness, and the protection of individual rights, should have been hailed as an ideal system by anyone whose goal is man's well-being. But that is not the collectivist's goal. A similar criticism is voiced by collectivist ideologists about the American Civil War. The North, they claim disparagingly, was motivated not by self-sacrificial concern for the plight of the slaves, but by the selfish economic interests of capitalism, which requires a free labor market. This last clause is true. Capitalism cannot work with slave labor. It was the agrarian feudal South that maintained slavery. It was the industrial capitalistic North that wiped it out, as capitalism wiped out slavery and serfdom in the whole civilized world of the 19th century. What greater virtue can one ascribe to a social system than the fact that it leaves no possibility for any man to serve his own interests by enslaving other men? What nobler system could be desired by anyone whose goal is man's well-being? But that is not the collectivist's goal. Capitalism has created the highest standard of living ever known on earth. The evidence is incontrovertible. The contrast between West and East Berlin is the latest demonstration, like a laboratory experiment for all to see. Yet those who are loudest in proclaiming their desire to eliminate poverty are loudest in denouncing capitalism. Man's well-being is not their goal. The underdeveloped nations are an alleged problem to the world. Most of them are destitute. Some, like Brazil, loot or nationalize the property of foreign investors. Others, like the Congo, slaughter foreigners, including women and children, after which all of them scream for foreign help, for technicians and money. It is only the indecency of altruistic doctrines that permits them to hope to get away with it. If those nations were taught to establish capitalism with full protection of property rights, their problems would vanish. Men who could afford it would invest private capital in the development of natural resources, expecting to earn profits. They would bring the technicians, the funds, the civilizing influence, and the employment which those nations need. Everyone would profit at no one's expense or sacrifice, but this would be selfish and therefore evil. According to the altruists' code, instead they prefer to seize men's earnings through taxation and pour them down any foreign drain and watch our own economic growth slow down year by year. Next time you refuse yourself some necessity you can't afford, or some small luxury which would have made the difference between pleasure and drudgery, ask yourself what part of your money has gone to pay for a crumbling road in Cambodia, or for the support of those selfless little altruists of the Peace Corps who play the role of big shots in the jungle at taxpayers' expense. If you wish to stop it, you must begin by realizing that altruism is not a doctrine of love, but of hatred for man. Collectivism does not preach sacrifice as a temporary means to some desirable end. Sacrifice is its end. Sacrifice as a way of life. It is man's independence, success, prosperity, and happiness that collectivists wish to destroy. Observe the snarling, hysterical hatred with which they greet any suggestion that sacrifice is not necessary, that a non-sacrificial society is possible to men, that it is the only society able to achieve man's well-being. If capitalism had never existed, any honest humanitarian should have been struggling to invent it. But when you see men struggling to evade its existence, to misrepresent its nature, and to destroy its last remnants, you may be sure that whatever their motives, love for man is not one of them. Blind chaos. There is an important political lesson to be learned from the current events in Algeria. President Kennedy has been waging an ideological war against ideology. He has been stating repeatedly that political philosophy is useless, and that sophistication consists of acting on the expediency of the moment. On July 31st, he declared to a group of Brazilian students that there are no rules or principles governing the means of providing progress, and that any political system is as good as any other, including socialism, as long as it represents a free choice of the people. On August 31st, just 1 month later, history, like a well-constructed play, gave him an eloquent answer. The people of Algiers marched through the streets of the city in desperate protest against the new threat of civil war, shouting, "We want peace, we want a government." How are they to go about getting it? Through the years of civil war, they have been united, not by any political philosophy, but only by a racial issue. They were fighting not for any program, but only against French rule. When they won their independence, they fell apart into rival tribes and armed wilayas fighting one another. The New York Times, September 2, 1962, described it as a bitter scramble for power among the men who were expected to lead the country. But to lead it where? In the absence of political principles, the issue of government is an issue of seizing power and ruling by brute force. The people of Algeria and their various tribal chieftains, who represent the majority that fought the war against France, are being taken over by a well-organized minority that did not appear on the scene until after the victory. That minority is led by Ben Bella and was armed by Soviet Russia. A majority without an ideology is a helpless mob to be taken over by anyone. Now consider the meaning of Mr. Kennedy's advice to the Brazilians and to the world. It was not the political philosophy of the United States that he was enunciating, but the principle of unlimited majority rule, the doctrine that the majority may choose anything it wishes, that anything done by the majority is right and practical because its will is omnipotent. This means that the majority may vote away the rights of a minority and dispose of an individual's life, liberty, and property until such time, if ever, as he is able to gather his own majority gang. This somehow will guarantee political freedom. But wishing won't make it so, neither for an individual nor for a nation. Political freedom requires much more than the people's wish. It requires an enormously complex knowledge of political theory and of how to implement it in practice. It took centuries of intellectual, philosophical development to achieve political freedom. It was a long struggle, stretching from Aristotle to John Locke to the founding fathers. The system they established was not based on unlimited majority rule, but on its opposite, on individual rights, which were not to be alienated by majority vote or minority plotting. The individual was not left at the mercy of his neighbors or his leaders. The constitutional system of checks and balances was scientifically devised to protect him from both. This was the great American achievement. And if concern for the actual welfare of other nations were our present leaders' motive, this is what we should have been teaching the world. Instead, we are deluding the ignorant and the semi-savage by telling them that no political knowledge is necessary, that our system is only a matter of subjective preference, that any prehistorical form of tribal tyranny, gang rule, and slaughter will do just as well with our sanction and support. It is thus that we encourage the spectacle of Algerian workers marching through the streets and shouting the demand, "Work, not blood," without knowing what great knowledge and virtue are required to achieve it. In the same way, in 1917, the Russian peasants were demanding land and freedom, but Lenin and Stalin is what they got. In 1933, the Germans were demanding room to live, but what they got was Hitler. In 1793, the French were shouting liberty, equality, fraternity. What they got was Napoleon. In 1776, the Americans were proclaiming the rights of man, and led by political philosophers, they achieved it. No revolution, no matter how justified, and no movement, no matter how popular, has ever succeeded without a political philosophy to guide it, to set its direction and goal. The United States, history's magnificent example of a country created by political theorists, has abandoned its own philosophy and is falling apart. As a nation, we are splintering into warring tribes, which, only by the fading momentum of a civilized tradition, are called economic pressure groups at present. As opposition to our growing statism, we have nothing but the futile wilayas of the so-called conservatives, who are fighting not for any political principles, but only against the liberals. embittered by Algeria's collapse into chaos, one of her leaders remarked, "We used to laugh at the Congolese. Now it goes for us. And it goes for us as well." Chapter 13, Let Us Alone, by Ayn Rand. Since economic growth is today's great problem, and our present administration is promising to stimulate it, to achieve general prosperity by ever wider government controls, while spending an unproduced wealth, I wonder how many people know the origin of the term laissez-faire. France, in the 17th century, was an absolute monarchy. Her system has been described as absolutism limited by chaos. The king held total power over everyone's life, work, and property, and only the corruption of government officials gave people an unofficial margin of freedom. Louis XIV was an archetypal despot, a pretentious mediocrity with grandiose ambitions. His reign is regarded as one of the brilliant periods of French history. He provided the country with a national goal in the form of long and successful wars. He established France as the leading power and the cultural center of Europe. But national goals cost money. The fiscal policies of his government led to a chronic state of crisis, solved by the immemorial expedient of draining the country through ever-increasing taxation. Colbert, chief advisor of Louis XIV, was one of the early modern statists. He believed that government regulations can create national prosperity, and that higher tax revenues can be obtained only from the country's economic growth. So he devoted himself to seeking a general increase in wealth by the encouragement of industry. The encouragement consisted of imposing countless government controls and minute regulations that choked business activity. The result was dismal failure. Colbert was not an enemy of business, no more than is our present administration. Colbert was eager to help fatten the sacrificial victims, and on one historic occasion he asked a group of manufacturers what he could do for industry. A manufacturer named Legendre answered, "Laissez-nous faire," let us alone. Apparently, the French businessmen of the 17th century had more courage than their American counterparts of the 20th, and a better understanding of economics. They knew that government help to business is just as disastrous as government persecution, and that the only way a government can be of service to national prosperity is by keeping its hands off. To say that that which was true in the 17th century cannot possibly be true today, because we travel in jet planes while they traveled in horse carts, is like saying that we do not need food as men did in the past, because we are wearing trench coats and slacks instead of powdered wigs and hoop skirts. It is that sort of concrete-bound superficiality, or inability to grasp principles, to distinguish the essential from the non-essential, that blinds people to the fact that the economic crisis of our day is the oldest and stalest one in history. Consider the essentials. If government controls could achieve nothing but paralysis, starvation, and collapse in a pre-industrial age, what happens when one imposes controls on a highly industrialized economy? Which is easier for bureaucrats to regulate, the operation of hand looms and hand forges, or the operation of steel mills, aircraft plants, and electronics concerns? Who is more likely to work under coercion? A horde of brutalized men doing unskilled manual labor, or the incalculable number of individual men of creative genius required to build and to maintain an industrial civilization? And if government controls fail even with the first, what depth of evasion permits modern statists to hope that they can succeed with the second? The statist's epistemological method consists of endless debates about single, concrete, out-of-context, range-of-the-moment issues, never allowing them to be integrated into a sum, never referring to basic principles or ultimate consequences, and thus inducing a state of intellectual disintegration in their followers. The purpose of that verbal fog is to conceal the evasion of two fundamentals. A, that production and prosperity are the product of men's intelligence, and B, that government power is the power of coercion by physical force. Once these two facts are acknowledged, the conclusion to be drawn is inevitable. that intelligence does not work under coercion, that man's mind will not function at the point of a gun. This is the essential issue to consider. All other considerations are trivial details by comparison. The details of a country's economy are as varied as the many cultures and societies that have existed, but all of mankind's history is the practical demonstration of the same basic principle, no matter what the variance of form. The degree of human prosperity, achievement, and progress is a direct function and corollary of the degree of political freedom, as witness ancient Greece, the Renaissance, the 19th century. In our own age, the difference between West Germany and East Germany is so eloquent a demonstration of the efficacy of a comparatively free economy versus a controlled economy that no further discussion is necessary. And no theorist can deserve serious consideration if he evades the existence of that contrast, leaving its implications unanswered, its causes unidentified, and its lesson unlearned. Now consider the fate of England, the peaceful experiment in socialism, the example of a country that committed suicide by vote. There was no violence, no bloodshed, no terror, merely the throttling process of democratically imposed government controls. But observe the present cries about England's brain drain, about the fact that the best and ablest men, particularly the scientists and engineers, are deserting England and running to whatever small remnant of freedom they can find anywhere in today's world. Remember that the Berlin Wall was erected to stop a similar brain drain from East Germany. Remember that after 45 years of a totally controlled economy, Soviet Russia, who possesses some of the best agricultural land in the world, is unable to feed her population and has to import wheat from semi-capitalist America. Read East minus West equals Zero by Werner Keller for a graphic and unrefuted picture of the Soviet economy's impotence, and then judge the issue of freedom versus controls. Regardless of the purpose for which one intends to use it, wealth must first be produced. As far as economics is concerned, there is no difference between the motives of Colbert and of President Johnson. Both wanted to achieve national prosperity. Whether the wealth extorted by taxation is drained for the unearned benefit of Louis XIV or for the unearned benefit of the underprivileged makes no difference to the economic productivity of a nation. Whether one is chained for a noble purpose or an ignoble one, for the benefit of the poor or the rich, for the sake of somebody's need or somebody's greed, when one is chained, one cannot produce. There is no difference in the ultimate fate of all chained economies, regardless of any alleged justifications for the chains. Consider some of these justifications. The creation of consumer demand. It would be interesting to compute how many housewives with relief checks would equal the consumer demands provided by Madame de Maintenon and her numerous colleagues. A fair distribution of wealth. The privileged favorites of Louis XIV did not enjoy so unfair an advantage over other people as do our aristocrats of pull, the actual and potential variants of Billy Solestes or Bob Baker. The requirements of the national interest? If there is such a thing as a national interest, achieved by sacrificing the rights and the interests of individuals, then Louis XIV acquitted himself superlatively. The greater part of his extravagance was not selfish. He did build France up into a major international power and wrecked her economy, which means he achieved prestige among other totalitarian rulers at the price of the welfare, the future, and the lives of his own subjects. The furtherance of our cultural or spiritual progress? It is doubtful that a government-subsidized theater project will ever produce an array of genius comparable to that supported by the court of Louis XIV in his role of patron of the arts, Corneille, Racine, Molière, etc. But no one will ever compute the stillborn genius of those who perish under systems of that kind, unwilling to learn the art of bootlicking required by any political patron of the arts. Read Cyrano de Bergerac. The fact is that motives do not alter facts. The paramount requirement of a nation's productivity and prosperity is freedom. Men cannot and morally will not produce under compulsion and controls. There is nothing new or mysterious about today's economic problems. Like Colbert, President Johnson is appealing to various economic groups, seeking advice on what he can do for them. And if he does not wish to go down in history with a record similar to Colbert's, he would do well to heed the voice of a modern legend, if such exists, who could give him the same immortal advice in a single word. Decontrol. Current State. Chapter 14, The Anatomy of Compromise, by Ayn Rand. A major symptom of a man's, or a culture's, intellectual and moral disintegration is the shrinking of vision and goals to the concrete-bound range of the immediate moment. This means the progressive disappearance of abstractions from a man's mental processes or from a society's concerns. The manifestation of a disintegrating consciousness is the inability to think and act in terms of principles. A principle is a fundamental, primary, or general truth on which other truths depend. Thus, a principle is an abstraction which subsumes a great number of concretes. It is only by means of principles that one can set one's long-range goals and evaluate the concrete alternatives of any given moment. It is only principles that enable a man to plan his future and to achieve it. The present state of our culture may be gauged by the extent to which principles have vanished from public discussion, reducing our cultural atmosphere to the sordid, petty senselessness of a bickering family that haggles over trivial concretes while betraying all its major values, selling out its future for some spurious advantage of the moment. To make it more grotesque, that haggling is accompanied by an aura of hysterical self-righteousness in the form of belligerent assertions that one must compromise with anybody on anything, except on the tenet that one must compromise, and by panicky appeals to practicality. But there is nothing as impractical as a so-called practical man. His view of practicality can best be illustrated as follows. If you want to drive from New York to Los Angeles, it is impractical and idealistic to consult a map and to select the best way to get there. You will get there much faster if you just start out driving at random, turning or cutting any corner, taking any road in any direction, following nothing but the mood and the weather of the moment. The fact is, of course, that by this method you will never get there at all. But while most people do recognize this fact in regard to the course of a journey, they are not so perceptive in regard to the course of their life and of their country. There is only one science that could produce blindness on so large a scale, the science whose job it was to provide men with sight: philosophy. Since modern philosophy, in essence, is a concerted attack against the conceptual level of man's consciousness, a sustained attempt to invalidate reason, abstractions, generalizations, and any integration of knowledge, men have been emerging from universities for many decades past with the helplessness of epistemological savages, with no inkling of the nature, function, or practical application of principles. These men have been groping blindly for some direction through the bewildering mass of, to them, incomprehensible concretes in the daily life of a complex industrial civilization, groping, struggling, failing, giving up, and perishing, unable to know in what manner they had acted as their own destroyers. It is therefore important, for those who do not care to continue that suicidal process, to consider a few rules about the working of principles in practice, and about the relationship of principles to goals. The three rules listed below are by no means exhaustive. They are merely the first leads to the understanding of a vast subject. 1. In any conflict between two men or two groups who hold the same basic principles, it is the more consistent one who wins. 2. In any collaboration between two men or two groups who hold different basic principles, it is the more evil or irrational one who wins. 3. When opposite basic principles are clearly and openly defined, it works to the advantage of the rational side. When they are not clearly defined but are hidden or evaded, it works to the advantage of the irrational side. 1. When two men or groups hold the same basic principles yet oppose each other on a given issue, it means that at least one of them is inconsistent. Since basic principles determine the ultimate goal of any long-range process of action, the person who holds a clearer, more consistent view of the end to be achieved will be more consistently right in his choice of means, and the contradictions of his opponent will work to his advantage psychologically and existentially. Psychologically, the inconsistent person will endorse and propagate the same ideas as his adversary, but in a weaker, diluted form, and thus will sanction, assist, and hasten his adversary's victory, creating in the minds of their disputed following the impression of his adversary's greater honesty and courage, while discrediting himself by an aura of evasion and cowardice. Existentially, every step or measure taken to achieve their common goal will necessitate further and more crucial steps or measures in the same direction, unless the goal is rejected and the basic principles reversed, thus strengthening the leadership of the consistent person and reducing the inconsistent one to impotence. The conflict will follow that course regardless of whether the basic principles shared by the two adversaries are right or wrong, true or false, rational or irrational. For instance, consider the conflict between the Republicans and the Democrats, and within each party, the same conflict between the conservatives and the liberals. Since both parties hold altruism as their basic moral principle, both advocate a welfare state or mixed economy as their ultimate goal. Every government control imposed on the economy, regardless in whose favor, necessitates the imposition of further controls to alleviate, momentarily, the disasters caused by the first control. Since the Democrats are more consistently committed to the growth of government power, the Republicans are reduced to helpless me-tooing, to inept plagiarism of any program initiated by the Democrats, and to the disgraceful confession implied in their claim that they seek to achieve the same ends as the Democrats, but by different means. It is precisely those ends, altruism, collectivism, statism, that ought to be rejected. But if neither party chooses to do it, the logic of the events created by their common basic principles will keep dragging them both further and further to the left. If and when the conservatives are kicked out of the game altogether, the same conflict will continue between the liberals and the avowed socialists. When the socialists win, the conflict will continue between the socialists and the communists. When the communists win, the ultimate goal of altruism will be achieved, universal immolation. There is no way to stop or change that process except at the root, by a change of basic principles. The evidence of that process is mounting in every country on earth. And observing it, the unthinking begin to whisper about some mysterious occult power called a historical necessity, which in some unspecified way, by some unknowable means, has preordained mankind to collapse into the abyss of communism. But there are no fatalistic historical necessities. The mysterious power moving the events of the world is the awesome power of men's principles, which is mysterious only to the practical modern savages who were taught to discard it as impotent. But, it might be argued, since the advocates of a mixed economy are also advocating freedom, at least in part, why does the irrational part of their mixture have to win? This leads us to the fact that, 2. In any collaboration between two men or groups who hold different basic principles, it is the more evil or irrational one who wins. The rational principle, premise, idea, policy, or action is that which is consonant with the facts of reality. The irrational is that which contradicts the facts and attempts to get away with it. A collaboration is a joint undertaking, a common course of action. The rational, the good, has nothing to gain from the irrational, the evil, except a share of its failures and crimes. The irrational has everything to gain from the rational, a share of its achievements and values. An industrialist does not need the help of a burglar in order to succeed. A burglar needs the industrialist's achievement in order to exist at all. What collaboration is possible between them, and to what end? If an individual holds mixed premises, his vices undercut, hamper, defeat, and ultimately destroy his virtues. What is the moral status of an honest man who steals once in a while? In the same way, if a group of men pursues mixed goals, its bad principles drive out the good. What is the political status of a free country whose government violates the citizens' rights once in a while? Consider the case of a business partnership. If one partner is honest and the other is a swindler, the latter contributes nothing to the success of the business, but the reputation of the former disarms the victims and provides the swindler with a wide-scale opportunity which he could not have obtained on his own. Now consider the collaboration of the semi-free countries with the communist dictatorships in the United Nations. To identify that institution is to damn it, so that any criticism is superfluous. It is an institution allegedly dedicated to peace, freedom, and human rights, which includes Soviet Russia, the most brutal aggressor, the bloodiest dictatorship, the largest-scale mass murderer and mass enslaver in all history, among its charter members. Nothing can be added to that fact, and nothing can mitigate it. It is so grotesquely evil an affront to reason, morality, and civilization that no further discussion is necessary, except for a glance at the consequences. Psychologically, the UN has contributed a great deal to the gray swamp of demoralization, of cynicism, bitterness, hopelessness, fear, and nameless guilt, which is swallowing the Western world. But the communist world has gained a moral sanction, a stamp of civilized respectability from the Western world. It has gained the West's assistance in deceiving its victims. It has gained the status and prestige of an equal partner. This book is continued on Disc 6.